turn off the display sleep, because that's really annoying. Working. So are you going somewhere nice for this cosy creative thing? Okay. So it's in the winter, it's a ski resort.
Yeah.
Mm. Someone check the live feed is okay for the room. If that's possible. is it that one there, the live K?
Yeah, it should work. I sometimes see the stream.
Okay. I should check it myself. Yep. That's freaky when you see a screen of a screen of a screen. Hello.
Something?
Hello? Can you hear me? Is it loud enough? Or do I need a headset? Is the headset better? Is the headset better, do you think?
Okay, just
is that one? Yeah?
There is a delay.
Oh. Really? That's good. Okay. I'll let you.
Welcome back. I assume that is a familiar face to you guys. Yes, I'm very happy to have Greg on stage today, talking about the very important topic. I was mentioning that already a couple of times, sooner or later you will conduct some psychophysical experiments, and then it's good to know or to distinguish between controlled and uncontrolled viewing conditions. So, yes,
yeah.
Very happy
okay.
to
Okay, thank you.
The stage is yours.
So, yeah, I suppose a brief introduction. My name is Gregory High. I'm hopefully getting towards the end of a PhD.
I will.
So my background is probably a bit different to yours, because I know you're into machine learning and AI and signal processing and engineering. I went to art school. So I started off in graphic design, and then I kind of got more interested in colour management and print production, and then colour science, and now here I am. So I suppose it's worth saying, you know, when you come to the colour lab, you've got all these people with different... It's very multidisciplinary, people with different backgrounds. So when it comes to the sort of the application in things like InDesign and Photoshop, and ICC colour management, that's I have some experience of using that in the workplace. Okay, so... I'm interested in looking at the differences between different colour reproduction devices. So I'm sure you know if you have two different displays or two different printers, they're capable of reproducing a slightly different range of colours. So we did a psychophysical experiment in the lab just before COVID hit. And so... to rescue the work, we kind of had to find a way of moving it online and then checking that it was, you know, the results that we got were valid. So this is our journey, really, moving our work from the lab to online. So what I'll do is I'll sort of break the afternoon into two sessions, hopefully with a quick cup of tea between the two. So part one, I'll give an overview of running experiments online. Give some examples, and also a live demonstration using QuickEval and PsychoPy and Pavlovia. And then in the second part, a case study. So that will be our experiment, how we moved it online and what the results told us about that. So as I say, the COVID-19 really, it messed up a lot of people's plans. And particularly people who were doing psychophysics in the lab, where you're going to be sat next to an observer or maybe handing them samples, and it just became untenable. And one of my colleagues, actually Helena, she got special dispensation to run an experiment, but she could only have one observer per day, and she had to get the cleaners in to clean the room after every session. So it just became hard work. But the things that we take for granted, like being in close proximity to people, giving them verbal instructions, and handing maybe physical samples to them, all of those things became difficult. And of course, in the lab, we can control the viewing environment very carefully. The lighting levels, we've got rooms with nice neutral grey walls. And of course, once you go outside of the lab, it's very difficult to replicate those viewing conditions. So the question really was, can we reliably move work online? So likely issues that we're going to run into, assuming that the observer is working on a PC, they could have different display types. They could be calibrated differently. So, someone might be on a laptop, someone might be on a high luminance, wide gamut desktop display. They could be different resolutions. And the physical dimensions, of course. These days, if you give someone a task to do online, can you stop them from doing it on a mobile phone or a tablet or a notebook? Or, one of these massive sort of 65-inch TVs. If your observers have got all those different viewing conditions, can you, what's that going to do to your results? And possibly you won't even know that that's happening. We've also got the problem of selecting observers, because when we're in the lab, we've got really good control over who we get to do our experiment. And usually we get people that we know, colleagues. We can get them to do maybe check against a colour vision deficiency, to do an Ishihara test. But also, we very often get them to practice the task before we actually do the main experiment. And you're giving information verbally, and you've got that instant feedback as to whether or not that person has kind of picked up what the expectations are and what they should be doing. Once you go online, how do you recruit people? Do you invite people? What if someone else outside that group gets hold of the link and does the experiment? How do you know that? And then there's the quality of the data capture. Even if you've got a sort of a rating scale, let's say 0 to 100, are people more consistent in the lab than if they're at home on a computer, for example? So can we take our existing study and move it online, and are the results valid? So this is a kind of a workflow for doing online experiments. And I forgot to... I'm okay just waving the cursor around here. So if we think we are researchers here, and we want to do an online experiment, so we need to use some kind of experiment builder app, which we'll come on to in a minute. And then that, in turn, is going to create our experiment. Now, obviously, to get that experiment to all the viewers, you need to host that online somewhere. So you also have to have a kind of an online host. And then to get people to come there, you need either some kind of recruitment platform. So I think you'll see with our work, we kind of push the limit on how many people you can invite to do an experiment. And there are sort of better tools for recruiting people if you want to cast your net wider. So then you have your participants who will take part in your experiment. You also need the hosting solution to store your data. Okay, and when you get your data back, your results, they need to be in a format which is usable to you. And so that then information is made available to you, the researchers. So very simply, that's the kind of the workflow that it seems to be quite consistent between different providers. And these are the kinds of experiments that you would run online. So have you heard about of these things like rank order, pair comparison, category judgment, magnitude estimation? So rank order, of course, you put things in order of, let's say, preference or order of lightness or glossiness or whatever the ness is that you're talking about. Pair comparison, typically you're making a forced choice between two stimuli. So, you know, which is the best, which is the sharpest. And at all of these, in fact, they could be, for example, two images, or they could be two images plus a reference image. So you might be asking, well, which image is closer to the original? Is it A or is it B? Okay. Category judgment. Very often you get these in questionnaires. So, you know, you would say, well, how would you describe this image? Is it very blurred, slightly blurred, very sharp? So you're kind of putting that continuum into bins in terms of category. And finally, magnitude estimation is simply, let's say, on a score 0 to 100, where do you rate this image? Like, how high is the quality, or how different are two images, for example? So this is where I do an advertisement for QuickEval. I don't know if you've seen this yet. So the Colour Lab, we have an online some online software which will help you run an experiment. And it was set up originally by Marius Pedersen. And we now have, it's a newer version now, and we have an external developer. So things are being added to it all the time. It's great for image quality and image comparison tasks. And one of the reasons is that on the web page, whereas usually images get sized to fit and therefore the images are resampled, QuickEval has a window where you get one image pixel per display pixel. So if there's any, for example, any artifacts in the image, then they are still visible on that display. So to take part with this, you need to you can take part in any experiments that are on there. But if you want to set up an experiment, then you will need to register as a scientist, in inverted commas, or researcher. And I think so that will be the tick box there at the bottom, register as a scientist. And then it will probably be Marius who will then give you access rights to setting up an experiment. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to swap over to the web browser now, and we'll actually set up a very quick experiment in QuickEval. So I'm going to log in. This is where I hope that my password... Okay, so you can see here we've got, in QuickEval, we've got an observer mode and a scientist mode. So in observer mode, I can see other people's experiments. But if I flip over to scientist mode, I can see my experiments that I've got here. Okay. So you've got a dashboard which gives you an overview, stimuli groups, which is essentially sets of images. Okay. And then your experiments. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to create three new image sets. So let's call this image set one. And then I'm going to add images to them. I'm going to browse. So let's three there, and as long as you've got a fairly quick internet connection, you can see that those are uploading. And I'll quickly make another two. Always dangerous doing a real-time demonstration. And finally, image set three.
So these images are prepared they beforehand are, according to certain attributes.
Exactly. Right? So I will show you those while that's loading. I'll show you these images. So what I've got here are a set of three images, and can you see that they're increasingly blurred? And these ones here as well. So that's a sort of sharpish one, blurred, even more blurred. So let's say we want to do, let's say, a pair comparison experiment. And you've got image one, image two, which is the sharpest, let's say, that's the question. So I can come in here, my experiments, I can create a new one. So let's, you can see here I've got a selection of different types of experiment. Let's choose paired comparison. And we'll call this you've got a few extra options here. So I'm going to display progress because I think if you're asking observers to do an experiment, it always helps to know how far through the experiment they are. Or I always think so if I'm the observer. You've got a couple of extras here. There's a bit in beta, which is adding the Ishihara colour vision deficiency test. There's also a tool now for marking up images. So if there's an area of interest, I won't click those now because I found that actually it slowed the experiment down quite a bit. So we can add some instructions. And we can add some images. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add image set one. And image set two, and image set three. So each one of those sets has got three images. So therefore, you've got three comparisons if we're working in pairs. So times three sets, so that's nine judgments that we're going to be asking our observers to make. You might think that it's important to randomise the order of the stimuli. So for example, in case there's a sort of a sequential effect, you might want, if there's a large difference followed by a small difference, you could actually be building in some kind of bias to your experiment. So randomising the order, but also the left-right presentation is important. unless of course you do both versions, left and right. So we're going to randomise the sets, but we're also we're going to randomise the order of the sets, and then we're going to randomise across the groups. So for example, I don't want all my image A's and then all my image B's and then all my image C's. I want to have a nice mix. And then if there is any bias in the order of the images, then across your, you know, however many, let's say hopefully 20 observers, that bias should kind of even itself out. So we've got a few settings here. This is quite important, which is the background. It's very traditional to have a mid-grey background, a neutral grey around your images. And so that's the, I believe, 80880, that's the hex code for a mid-grey. And you can mess around with the time delay. Observer inputs, we'll come on to this. You can capture information about your observers, but if you capture information that is can identify them later, then we really cross a threshold into GDPR territory, and we'll come on to that later. So actually, I'm going to say nickname. So it might be that rather than getting someone's name, age, date of birth, maybe something like a nickname or a observer number is more anonymous. And then we can publish. So what I'll do then is I'll copy that link and then just paste it in as though I was an observer. So this is my experiment. Let's put my nickname in. Okay, here's what the instructions are. In this case, we're going to say, let's say, which is the sharpest image? I think it's the one on the right. Okay. One on the right. On the right. On the right. On the right.
So no bias.
Okay, this is a strongly worded email to the developer, I think. I've had this actually, this problem was fixed because I did a pilot experiment and I suddenly realised that 80% of the time people were choosing the one on the right. And after being freaked out, I suddenly realised that it wasn't as random as I had hoped. So this actually means that the problem, the issue that was fixed, is now no longer fixed. Okay. Unless, is it like if you roll a dice enough times?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, on the right. Right. Right.
Right.
So one actually, it's useful to have a set of test images, not images, but just like a letters and numbers, A, B, and C, and then you can very easily see which one turns up on the left and on the right and in which order. So we've just found something, that's a good lesson, is when you're using other people's software, you're very much trusting that it's doing what you think it's doing. So don't use it for about a week. Give it a week and we'll fix it. Okay, so once you're done, obviously you want to look at your results. So it won't do anything because we've only had one observer, but you can see here that on the stats page, it will start to generate some image stats for you in terms of usage and Z-scores. Okay, and if we go to observers, we can click on, let's say, that one there. I think that was me. And let's export it to HTML. And this is what gets returned. So it, you can get it back as an Excel spreadsheet or as a text file. So you can see here, where are we? This is the essentially all the parameters relating to this experiment. The images and image sets. And here are the results. So you can see here we have a left image and a right image, and then which one was selected, and also how long I spent doing it. So what this means is if you've got an experiment and you've pre-prepared your images, this is a fantastic kind of engine for running your experiment. And it means you don't have to invest the time setting up this software, because setting up bespoke experiments is really, really time consuming. And even if you want to just test the concept, you could get this up and running really quickly. So that's my advertisement for QuickEval. So if you want to go beyond QuickEval, there are plenty of other tools that you could use. So I've broken this up into, for example, on the left, builder applications. You can see here there's a mix of JavaScript and also Python solutions. There are pros and cons of each. Python's particularly good if you're running it on a PC in the lab, like, and you've got your observer next door. So if you're dealing with very large files, that actually is going to perhaps be a sensible way of working. But if you want to move it online, you're going to need a JavaScript version of the experiment. So you may be forced to have a situation where you need both a Python and a JavaScript version simultaneously. So there's a few tools here, but the one that we used and we'll come on to later is called PsychoPy. Then you have to have a hosting service, and there are free ones, there are paid for ones, and we went with this one called Pavlovia, which is pay per click. So you only pay use a credit when your observer finishes the experiment, and it's like 10 cents an observer, something like that. So recruiting observers can be difficult. We've done it by invitation only within the Colour Lab and at other universities. But my colleague Simon, who is a psychologist, he's been using Prolific as his recruitment platform. So again, the observers are actually being paid, right? And you pay Prolific, and Prolific then pay the observer for their time. Simon found that was quite, it works for him, but the Amazon Mechanical Turk has got a bit of a bad reputation, because although it pays, you're using it to pay the observers, you think, well, if you don't know the observer and they're just motivated by money, how good an observer are they? You know, why? What is their motivation for being a consistent observer in your experiment? So in some ways, these recruitment platforms are good if you want big data, if you want hundreds and hundreds of observers. But it does raise questions about the quality. And finally, at the bottom there's a few corporate-type solutions that do everything. They've got a builder app, hosting, and recruiting combined. Okay, so this is a quick overview of PsychoPy, and this is the one that we used. It's Python-based, so you download the application, it downloads a distribution of Python specifically for that application. So it isn't too much of a problem that if you're running the wrong version of Python. However, they do have a habit of updating and making changes. And I found that when I went back to an experiment I'd done a year before, that experiment no longer worked. I had to essentially go through and make every page again. So it's a combination of sort of GUI type workflow. You can see here that we've got these bars that are a bit like a sort of a timeline, and at the bottom a sort of kind of a workflow diagram. So you can build elements that are built in, like mouse click or user keyboard, or if there's something you want to do specifically, you can do your own sort of coding snippets. And if you look down here on the bottom right-hand corner, you can see a coding window with a left and a right-hand side. And in fact, here I've on the left I've got Python, and on the right I've got JavaScript. So what PsychoPy does is it will actually do its very best to create both a JavaScript version of the Python. And it does a reasonable job. But if you've done some bespoke coding, then you will possibly also have to do the bespoke coding in JavaScript as well. So this came originally from the University of Nottingham. It's been around for a few years, and it's a big favourite with psychologists, but it's still a great tool if you want to do sort of visual studies. And this was the hosting platform. This is Pavlovia. This is also at University of Nottingham. So essentially, it runs like a web host for your... and makes a web page for a website for your experiment. But it also acts as like a GitHub for your experiments. So when you host, you also upload your Python experiment. And if you're in a collaborative environment, so for example, if you were in a large research group and you had several people working on the project, then everyone could work on this particular distribution and make changes if they wanted to. As I said, it is chargeable, so we prepaid for some credits, and then it's kind of pay-per-click. I still have some credits left from my experiment, so just as an offer, if anyone does a Pavlovia experiment, I could probably transfer some credits over to you, rather than you have to find the money. And then at the end of the experiment, it downloads the results as an Excel spreadsheet. Let me quickly go... Okay. So we spoke a bit about collecting data. I'm sure you've heard of this thing called GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation. It's quite strong in the EU... So you probably noticed that when you click on a web page, you have to every time, do you accept cookies? Do you accept cookies? It's all about consenting to people having your data. But there are also local requirements in Norway, and they are particularly strict. And essentially, if you're collecting personal data, really you need to have your experiment approved by this Norwegian Centre for Research Data, the NSD. And really what makes something personal data is if you could identify that individual from the data. So arguably, even if you hold someone's name and email address, you would fall underneath their remit. There's also the issue of where you store your data. It may be that the data has to be kept within the EU. It can't be on a data centre somewhere around the world. There are issues like how secure is that data, because if someone else could get to it. And free services like Google Forms, you know, it, you really, these companies say it's secure, but how do you know? So, in fact, we NTNU has got a deal with Microsoft. So, if you were to use the MS Forms via NTNU, an NTNU's account, it will be kept on NTNU servers. So we're generally we are encouraged to use the Microsoft solutions there. And so one way of keeping things straight in this regard is to separate the experimental data from the observer's personal data. And of course, if you use one of these recruiting platforms, that's exactly what they do. So the recruiting platform knows the age, the name, the gender, the address, the telephone number. But as a researcher, all you get is observer 1, observer 2, observer 3. So I suppose one of the benefit of these professional solutions is that they take away that some of that responsibility. And just to reiterate, there are these paid-for recruitment and screening solutions. So, for example, let's say you've got 1,000 potential observers, but you only want ones which were in a certain age range. And then you could perhaps sort through to get a kind of a subset of observers that you need. And so this is the website for the NSD. It really puts a spanner in the works, if I'm honest. I shouldn't say that it's being recorded. certainly, there are ethical considerations, for example, if you're doing anything to do with medical imaging. We've got a colleague, Fereshta, a postdoc here. She's currently capturing... it's essentially simulation of scattering underneath the skin. And so she's capturing people's arms and people's faces and then perhaps trying to reconstruct people's features. And, I mean, immediately they had to sort of get clearance from NSD for this. But I've also seen master's students, say, run an experiment and they ask age, name, email, and they want to record the session. And you think, well, if you're actually recording someone's voice, then really you are crossing that line into something that needs to be reviewed in terms of the ethics. So erring towards anonymisation is perhaps an easier task, particularly when you're starting out.
Advice. But if you want to distinguish the results and you want to look into the age or gender, then you may need to take this into account in the time management. Otherwise, it's going to be a struggle.
Yeah. And I guess the more public your experiment is, the more important it is that if you're going to publish, for example, or if... if your observers are the people in this room, you probably guess who the observer is. But if you're advertising your experiment elsewhere, then it does become a consideration. So let's have a quick look. Time is going very quickly. I was going to do a demo of PsychoPi before we take a break. So... I think I've covered most of this, but one of the things about PsychoPi is that there is quite a large user group. So if you do go and use PsychoPi, there are plenty of YouTube videos and user forums. And if there's something that doesn't work, the chances are someone else will have come across that as well. Okay. So this is PsychoPi. And you can see here that we've essentially got a user interface with a timeline. And you've on the right, you've got some sort of preset tools, like using the mouse, using text, and so on. And at the bottom, you've got a flow chart of routines, okay, and loops. So I'm just going to quickly call this demo. And let's say we want some text. So I'm going to call this text. And the time here is the time at which the text appears on the screen. So I'm going to say 0.5 seconds. So there'll be a slight delay before the text appears. How long does that last? I want the text to stay there, so I'm going to make that blank. And then we can say, "Hello world, please click to exit." Okay. So you can see here that our text is going to appear on the screen after half a second. And then I'll quickly add a mouse click. I shall call it mouse. Again, we want it to be live continuously. So this will end the routine, which is this unit here, on any mouse click. Okay. So then quickly I'll run this, and I need to save it. And it thinks about it. This is when it crashes, obviously. Okay, so it's asking us for a participant. This is a new feature. It offers you like a random number. Okay. And then... Hey, there's our text. "Hello world, please click to exit." So if I click, it exits. Okay. So that... very simply, is how you bring your elements in and you control them against a timeline. And I've got a demo here. Okay, so this is a slightly more complex version. What I've done here is I've got an introduction, which is hello. I've got an ending page, which is thank you for taking part. And then in the middle, I've got essentially a pair comparison type of task. So you can see here I've got an image elements for left-hand and right-hand images and some instructions and the mouse click. And I've also got here some code. So what I do at the start of the experiment is I'm actually loading up a couple of Python functions, the random and the XL random. And then at the beginning of each routine... This is me randomizing the right-hand and left-hand presentation of the images. So on the left, there's the Python version, and on the right, there's the JavaScript version. So you can see here, I'm creating a random 1 or 0, and if x equals 0, then image A is on the left and image B is on the right, otherwise the other way around. And then I'm dumping out the decisions that were made there into the results. And you can see here the slight difference between the Python and the JavaScript versions. So I'm careful here that I'm using the same variable names, but the syntax is different. Okay, and the other thing is, can you see here at the bottom, there's this kind of loop? I wonder if I can make that bigger. No. So PsychoPy works on the idea that if you've got, say, 10 comparisons, you don't have 10 routines. You have one routine and you loop it 10 times. So this loop here, the order is randomised. And can you see here that it's picking up something called conditions from an Excel spreadsheet? So, how do I get out? That's it. So what I've got here is I've got a folder of images, which are the blurred peacock again, and then I've got a spreadsheet, and you can see here image A and image B. I've got 1 versus 2, 1 versus 3, and 2 versus 3. So I've actually, in each row, I have my comparison, and the spreadsheet is picked up by PsychoPy, and that's quite nice, because once you've set up your experiment, if you want to use different images, you just give it a different Excel spreadsheet. So we can run that on here. That's more than half a second, but hello world. Click to continue. Click on the best image. Let's say the one on the left, the one on the left, the one on the right. It was random. Yes. Thank you. Click to end. And what it does, if it's on your local machine, is it puts the results into a data folder. And there you can see it's comma separated. Will that let me do a quick look? Okay, so you can see here that these are my results. So this was image 1, image 2, 1 and 3, 2 and 3. The presentation order, so there was it left or was it right? Do you remember X was 0 or X was 1? You've got the left-hand image, right-hand image, and even which mouse button I used, left, middle or right. And you can see here, in this case, I clicked on the left hand or the right hand. And that was me, the participant. So instantly you get your results back as a Excel spreadsheet. And then this is the bit that where it may or may not work. I'm going to try and host it on Pavlovia. Okay, so it's got this kind of, I've got a user account here on Pavlovia. So if I... No, it doesn't like it.
So if the students need 10 observers to conduct a particular experiment using PsychoPy, yeah, then Pavlovia is not needed.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I've been talking for a while, so shall we take a break? I really wanted to show you how that goes up into Pavlovia. So... on the website, I can log in and I have a dashboard. These are my credits, and here is a list of my experiments. Demo finished. I wonder if that was. client's not happy. Okay, so essentially you can see there on the hosting side how you can, once you upload your experiment, you can see how you can manage them, you can make them active or inactive, and each one then has a web link that you can send to your observers.
If the point is if they run the experiment outside, so then where is the collector, where is the data collected?
So it's collected in Pavlovia,
yeah,
exactly. If you host
then
it there.
You need Pavlovia.
Yes.
As
yeah.
long as you do it on site, on your own, and the observers come to the lab, then it is on your hard disk.
Exactly. So has anyone got any questions on that so far? Or
they have not started yet with the experiment.
Okay. So shall we take a 10-minute break?
Yeah. Continue for
okay.
the past.
I'll be okay here.
doctors second hand, you have failed at that, no? So Finn.no is more like eBay, if you will. It's like people put it out yeah, and you can complete your life from them. Yeah. So, or like you send them a message usually, just ask them if they're still free, and then they'll give you the address.
Wait until Peter comes back. I think he's the answer. Have we got everyone, do you think? Yeah. Okay, so what I thought we'd do in the second part is to look at the experiment that we ran as a pilot about 2 years ago, and then over the last year, a much larger version of the experiment. So this is where we take a lab-based experiment, and we're going to move it online. So previously in the lab, we had done some work on visual difference. So I'm interested in consistent colour appearance. That is to say, how do we get visual consistency between images when they are reproduced on different devices? And so the simple question was, well, how different are they? And could we reduce that visual difference down to a single metric, a sort of a delta V? And would that be useful? So you can see here a simulation of four prints on different substrates and different printing devices. So the one on the left might be printing onto coated paper on a litho press. And the one on the right could be something like a newspaper advertisement. So the image difference includes the substrate colour around. And for image quality, certainly in the print, when it's print-based, there is a tradition of having this unprinted border around the image so that the substrate colour is visible. So the question is, could we establish a kind of metric of difference between these colour gamuts using a range of images? So for the pilot, we chose just four gamuts. And what we wanted was an even distribution of volume gamut, but also the different white points, the substrate colours, and also the contrast ratio, so that, for example, in newsprint, the darkest colour that can be printed is actually charcoal grey. It's not a kind of a deep black that you would get on a photo print. So you can see here our four different profiles. You can see here in reducing gamut volume, so in the C-Lab space, you can think of a gamut as a 3D volume. And we have decreasing white point and increasing black point L star lightnesses. And paper colours tend to fall into rough groups. So in this case, some look a little bit bluish. So if you have a minus B star, typically that looks a bit bluish. And if you've got a positive B star, that tends to look a little bit yellowish. You can see that three of the four gamuts have got very similar shapes. And the reason for that is that printers tend to use the standard ink sets. So there is a kind of a built-in consistency there. And that the third one, the gravure gamut, you can see that the yellow is a bit more orangey than the rest. And as a result, there is a reduced gamut in the green. So you can see here. So that third gamut is a little bit different. So what I wanted to do was do yet another demo. But I wanted to show you these gamuts and these profiles of the gamuts in a program called ColorThink, which is fantastic for visualizing images and gamuts in the C-Lab color space. And then compare the volumes of these gamuts and then show you how these profiles are used in soft-proofing, for example, in Photoshop, whereby you can simulate one device on another device. So, let's just hide that. So this is a program called ColorThink. It's by a company called Chromix, an American company. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to I'm going to add just two profiles initially. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I had it mirrored. It's because PowerPoint is still running. Apologies. That's better. So I've got two gamuts here, and I can put one in wireframe and one as a solid. So the larger of the two gamuts is typical of a litho, four-colour litho print on, say, a coated paper. And the smaller gamut is associated with a newspaper. So you can see here, if you think about the LAB colour space, obviously the vertical scale is lightness with white at the top and black at the bottom. And then you have these two opponent channels. You've got a blue to yellow, which is the B star, and then a green to red, which is A star. And you can see here that the newsprint, the colour of the newsprint substrate is a lot more yellowish than the coated paper, which is what you would expect, because typically when you open up a newspaper, it's a bit yellowy. And you can see here then that based on the profiles, we can either calculate or get an encoding of the gamut boundary descriptor, in other words, the outer shell of the gamut. And inside the gamut, then we can describe that as a volume, and we can describe that in C-Lab units in three dimensions. So, if you like, cubic units of LAB. So, what I could do here is I've also got an image. I'm just going to open that with Photoshop as well. Okay, so that's my image. So it's quite colourful. It's a CMYK image. We've got the border, which where there is no ink at all. And we've got quite a few different high chroma colours, but it's predominant. There's this predominant large area of blue. And so this scatter plot actually represents the distribution of colours in that image. So you can see that an image doesn't necessarily use the full gamut of a printing device or a display device. But it is constrained by that. So you can see here this large area of blues, which relates to, obviously, the area here. And so if we were to map in Photoshop, how would you go about that if you wanted to convert from a litho print to newsprint? How would you do that in Photoshop? Okay, hopefully it comes with a profile embedded in the image. That's ideal, because then you know what that image was designed to be used for. So what's if you're going from that profile and then you're going to do what?
Convert.
Yes. Yep. And which rendering intent would you use?
Depends on the image that you want to print.
It does. If it's a photographic image,
there's the three type of intents. I know it's different from the purpose. If you want to print some photography, then that's the best rendering intent. And then also, if you want to print some logos, it's like just not very rich in color. There's also another intent.
Yep.
So
yep.
I'm not really familiar, but I know that's different.
Because there's also the thing is how different are the two gamuts. Because if they're very similar, all you're going to have is a few high chroma colours that are clipped. But when you've got two profiles which are very different, really you need a perceptual rendering. So in this case, what I'm going to do is take that image and show it as vectors and convert it to the newspaper. And it thinks about it. And we can say the perceptual rendering. And it disappears. Here we go. So you can actually see how those colours are being mapped from one image to the other. Okay. So what that means then is that the images, whether they're in newsprint or a magazine or a photo print, we want them to look consistent, and yet it's within the constraints of each individual device. And so we can think of that as a sort of a subjective visual difference, because it might be that some attributes, we're more sensitive to some attributes than others. And also there's this idea of acceptability. You know, if you see a newspaper advertisement, do you think that looks terrible? And the answer is no, it looks okay. But it only looks terrible when you put it next to, let's say, a photo print of the same image. And then you realise, oh, you know, we've lost contrast, we've lost colour, and so on. So in Photoshop, we can exactly as I don't know your names yet, but you mentioned this, the absolute colorimetric rendering intent.
Yeah, that's one of the rendering intents. Yeah. Absolute, perceptual, and then another one, and I don't remember.
Yeah.
My name is Dia, by the way.
Oh, hello. So we're going to use that now, or at least Photoshop is going to use that behind the scenes. Okay, so I'll do it manually first. What I'm going to do is I'm going to convert to newsprint using the perceptual rendering intent and strangely it looks like not much has happened. And this is something that Photoshop does and is not particularly well advertised, is that when you're looking at an image, it maps the white point of whatever you're looking at to the white point of the display. It's a media relative transform. But that's not very helpful if you're trying to preview how it would look on newsprint. So although it looks like the substrate is bright white, if I bring up the info panel and put it on LAB, see, that's showing an L star of 100, which is just not true of newsprint. So what I'm going to do is I'm now going to convert it to LAB using the absolute colorimetric intent. And can you see now that what we've got is essentially we've got the true LAB values. So can you see there it's got an L star of 85? And then what it's doing is it's then mapping that L star of 85 relative to the white point of the display. Because as well as having different prints, we've got three different displays going on. And so in each of these three displays, that newsprint is being shown relative to the white point of the display.
Remember that is what we did in the last frame, because all paper now Greg is printing out on the screen.
So I'm just going to undo those. And let's say you wanted to preview that in Photoshop to see, well, what would happen if you made that conversion? So under the view menu, you've got this proofing set up. And I'm going to put it on custom. I'm going to choose my newsprint. You can see I've collected quite a few profiles. There we are, using the perceptual rendering. And then here, can you see that it will either simulate the paper colour and also the black ink? And so the paper has this sort of grey yellowish look. And if you look at the sort of maybe sort of the darkest elements in the image, you can see that really they're not that dark because the contrast ratio has been reduced. So these are the profiles and the transforms. This is what they're for. It's for transforming content from one device to another, and hopefully in a way that looks good and is consistent, and can be previewed.
Now again, we could ask the question: now in this simulation, did the RGB numbers change or not? Because that was a kind of a debate. By assigning it and having an input profile and the monitor profile, and then the appearance changed.
Yes. Right.
Or when the pixel values remain the same before and after the new appearance.
So the answer to that is, let's get this right. If you have got an unprofiled RGB image and you put it on two different displays, you've got the same RGB values but two different appearances. So, for example, one might have a dull green primary, the other one might have a bright green primary. You'd have this horrible colour shift. So what the colour management does is it uses XYZ and LAB as a kind of an exchange space. So you take the LAB values from device A and you try to replicate those on device B. So then you have different RGB values, but hopefully the same appearance. So if you do need to do a lot of image transforms and you've got good profiles, you can automate this process. Imagine if you had to transform every image in MATLAB, it would be a nightmare. So I've given you that overview because I think that explains a lot about D device gamuts and how they affect the appearance.
Meanwhile, I have another advertisement. You showed Chromex software.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, NTNU does not have kind of access to the student license for that. But some years back, some students developed kind of a similar type of software called ICC. 3D. So if you look up ICC 3D in Google, then you get linked to the Colorlab website, and I think it should still run on a PC.
Yeah, it's on the it's on the Higgs server, so that it's still there.
No,
file not down. Oh, it's a potential security risk.
So there is. There has never been written any manual, you know. So you need to spend some time to dig into. So it's a student user interface. It's not a commercial user interface. So, but it's an excellent software where you also can convert an image into a 3D color space. Then you can do some gamut mapping, pushing these pixels into the gamut, and then accordingly the two-dimensional image gets updated. And it has different functions for calculating gamut volume, dependent on the gamut boundary descriptor that you're using, segment maxima and convex hull. So it's an interesting tool to explore and to get a kind of a better understanding what is happening, and if you do not have to buy commercial software. So.
No, that's good.
Okay.
Okay. So. Using exactly that approach, converting using the perceptual rendering intent and then converting back using the absolute colour metric and then converting media relative to sRGB or Adobe RGB, we've got on here an on-screen simulation of those prints on as they would appear on the substrate. And this, I have to say that having a large format display with this very large neutral grey background also really helps, because in a sense it gets very close to replicating how it would look if you put the physical prints inside a viewing booth. So consistent with graphic arts, we calibrated the display to a D50 white, the chromaticity of D50. Peak luminance was 160 candelas. That's about the equivalent of, is it 500 lux? Or lumen? So 160 candelas is equivalent to 500 lux, roughly, I think.
Right, times P, approximately.
Yes, so it is, yes. So essentially, there's this thing called P2 viewing conditions, which it's the luminance that you would get in a viewing booth. So we were essentially trying to replicate the viewing experience of a viewing booth. And so you can see here we've got four different reproductions, and we simply asked each observer to rate the overall difference on, in this case, a scale of 0 to 9, but later we used 0 to 100. And you can see that, obviously, the difference between A and D is much bigger than A and B. Well, I hope you can. I've had a few observers that can't. So also, we instead of just using one image, we used a set of images. In this case, they started off as an sRGB reference set. Typically, you want a range of different images. So, for example, here in the you've got a lot of sort of silverware and neutral colours, and then we've also got a couple of synthetic images, and this one here is Phil Green's gamut boundary descriptor. So these are colours that you would expect to be all the way around the outside of the gamut. So, in the lab, this is with our profiled display under controlled viewing conditions, we had some colour lab observers. And then a few years ago, CIC was actually, the conference was in Lillehammer. So we suddenly had all these experts descend upon us. So I managed to get 8 of them to do the experiment. And it's an interesting question whether expert, in inverted commas, observers, are they better or are they consistent with normal observers? And I think you can see here that there was very little difference between the two sets of observers. And in fact, considering that the low numbers involved, I would say they're really very similar. It's always important, as well as on any graph, is to put an indication of the variability or the the observer uncertainty. So I think in this case it was the 95th percentile that I used. So with one exception here, there's no significant difference between the groups. So I was thinking, maybe there would be this huge difference, but there wasn't. And then we started to look at the relationship between the visual difference, this delta V, and the gamut volume. So I was taking the ratio of the two volumes, at largest to smallest. And I think, you get quite an interesting relationship. So, for example, the largest visual difference is between A and D, which is up here, and the smallest visual difference is between A and B, which is down here. And although we've only got 6 data points, I think, there's definitely a sense that there is a continuum here, that there is a kind of a relationship between the ratio of the gamut volumes and the visual difference. Okay, so we'd achieved that, and now COVID happened. So we invested the time to learn PsychoPi and Pavlovia and moved exactly the same experiment online. The only difference being that we don't know what the observers are doing. We don't know their viewing conditions. We don't know their operating system. Is it nighttime? Is it a bright room? Even the displays, you could have different white points, you could have different luminances, different colour gamuts. So this particular, we changed a few things. Mainly it was the rating scale. We went from 0 to 100. And this is a preview of our user interface. And you can see that we've got our two images, and we're asking the observer to rate a scale 0 to 100 using a slider. And generally, we got it so that you could either use the mouse or you could use the keyboard. And the idea was that you wanted people to keep concentrated on the display. You don't want people looking away all the time. And I think because it's web-based, you can see that obviously it's going to work on different devices. And one of the great things about PsychoPi is that it resizes the user interface for every display relative to the height of the display. And what that means then is whether someone's got a widescreen or a standard 4x3, we know that the experiment will still fit on the display. So, shall I show you the experiment? If we go back to Pavlovia, here we are, you can see that actually this turned into 10 different experiments. So I'm just going to pick one here. And I'm going to run it. You can see there's a lot of images involved, and so it's downloading them all at the start of the experiment. And I had a couple of former colleagues who were logging on in China, and they said, you know, it just took for ages, forever, for these images to download. So things like image size, file size, bandwidth, download time. These are also practical constraints on how you build your experiment. So let's hit OK. You can see how it's a four, but it has essentially scaled the user interface by the height. I think because I'm doing some kind of display mirroring, that's why we've got a little bit of clipping here on the side. So here we are, visual difference between images. Welcome to the experiment. This is this idea of openness and consent of the observer. So those are my contact details, so anyone could get hold of me. We asked a question about colour vision. Of course, we can't test that because we're not with the observers. But we asked people to please say, you know, if they have a known colour vision deficiency, please don't do the experiment. Choice of web browsers. We did run into a few problems with earlier versions of Firefox. But the other three main browsers, Safari, Edge and Chrome, do a pretty good job of the colour management. So if you've got sRGB images in a web browser and your display is not sRGB, then the browser does the colour management for you. So it picks up the display profile and does probably a media relative transform. So what that means is even if someone's on a wide gamut display, they're still looking at roughly sRGB images. And then you will be asked to estimate the visual difference between pairs of images. The task should take approximately 20 to 25 minutes. Again, it's all about giving people information. The data is anonymized, so please give a nickname. And also what we did was we did a separate online questionnaire at the end. So we can ask sort of generic questions like age group, and what operating system you use, that kind of thing. But that will be separate from the experiment. Okay, and once again, all the data is anonymized. So image familiarization. I give people an overview of the kind of differences that they're likely to encounter. And then we have a training session, because if observers are not familiar with the experiment, would you really trust their first and second and third attempts? No. So people need this kind of warm-up period. And did you see at CVCS, Simon's paper? His hypothesis is that as you go through an experiment, people's performance actually changes. So if you randomise the order of the presentation, I mean, you can hopefully remove that bias, but it's an interesting topic. So we've got two images. How different are they? Let's say that's 50. I think the difference is less there. So let's say 25. That's a lot different. Let's say 70 or 80. That's really different. So 90. And you think, right, do I use 0 and 100? You know, it's one of the interesting things that comes out of this is that all observers use a slightly different scale. So someone might be really mean and only use like 0 to 30. And someone else might use the whole range. Someone else might score higher. So actually we came across a method of normalising that after the event.
Because if you start to experiment with some images, you need a kind of your own calibration, because you don't know what is coming next. So is that a kind of a huge difference, or is that a small difference? So is the next image, you know, three times as big as this? So it needs a kind of a adaptation process, so you need to get your own calibration. Once you are there, you have an overview, then you basically just produce.
And there was this idea of, should there be almost like a calibration page, so that if when people are halfway through the experiment, they can kind of go back and look at the scatter of images. Okay. And let's say this one's a 60. And let's say that's a 40. So that was the experiment. I won't take you through the next however many slides there are. I think I've put a counter on it. So you can see down here, this is one of 77. So people know how far they are through the experiment. So we had 10 experiments. We got over 20 observers for each one. So that's over 200 observers. So we're in the process now of crunching through all this data to see what we can find.
So maybe what is also interesting to add is, what about two things, the inter and intra observer variability, meaning that how do you perform? You know, if you have, let's say, 10 comparisons, then it is interesting to know how do you perform if the same images appear again. Do you give the same rating, or you give a different rating? Mm-hmm. And that gives an information about your own performance. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is the performance across all the observers. So how big is that distribution? Is it a small distribution, or is it a huge distribution between my experiment and your experiment? Mm.
I have a question. Mm. So when you tell an observer that choose it, especially when you're scaling, tell the person that how much difference, is there some sort of, like, the person already becomes biased. There should be a difference. So does it, like, include some sort of, like, showing the same image, making sure that the person is not acting biased while rating? Is there some sort of...
What I did was, you would do the experiment twice. Okay? That's not practical with an online experiment. But what I did do was I took a subset of images and repeated them at the end. So I've at least got, not the whole experiment, but at least I've got a snapshot of maybe how consistent, internally consistent, that observer is. And
but still, like, the idea of being biased, that there should be a difference. So I make myself to see the difference, because this happens.
Yeah. So that particular scale goes to 0.
Yeah,
okay.
Zero, maybe.
Yeah, but, like, people usually are like, no, there should be a difference. I don't know if that happened, like... I've seen people doing this.
Or
when you tell them that rate this based on difference, they assume that there should be a difference. Like, it's very unlikely for them to go for 0. So, like, I think that, like, at least 2-3 specimens should be like that, so that we could know if the person really sees that 0.
I would, the counter argument is that people don't like, in inverted commas, trick questions. So when you have two very similar images and people, is it one pixel that's different, you know? Whereas, of course, I was asking about the overall difference.
Okay.
So I feel that if an observer thinks that, that there's some kind of setup there, they can feel, what's the word, resentful towards that.
Okay.
But it's you almost need some images that act as a kind of a calibration point. And in fact, to bring our 10 experiments together, we had another subset of normalization images. And they were specifically large differences and small differences, so that it would, that those would then help bring it all together.
I also have a quick question.
Mm.
So are you also keeping record of how time does the subject takes to respond or to distinguish?
Yeah, so Pavlovia, it will say how long is the whole experiment, but also how long each slide takes, and also how long the response is. So if someone, let's say, scores 80 and then goes away for a cup of coffee and comes back, it doesn't say, oh, it took 10 minutes. It knows how long the response was for the slider. So, of course, sometimes if someone has a coffee and then comes back and then changes it again, you say, oh, well, that decision took 10 minutes. But overall, you have this kind of idea. You can take maybe the maximum, the minimum, and the average response time. And it's interesting to say, well, someone who's inconsistent, do they work faster or do they work slower? So speed and quality of response is not necessarily correlated. But you're right. It's all about gathering information on the observer's behaviour. Okay, so that was our demo. And let's compare our online experiment with the lab-based one we did before. So what I did was I just scaled. Do you remember originally we had 0 to 9 in the lab version? So I've scaled that 0 to 100. And that in itself may cause some problems. But it looks like, on average, that the lab-based people rate the visual difference higher than online people by quite a long way. Okay, and it does look to be consistent as well. So if we want to combine these results, we need this idea of normalization. This is a name you will become familiar with, which is Engeldrum. He's the sort of the guru of image statistics. So he proposes something called a group mean scale normalization. And so what that does, it's very close to a geometric mean. But what it does, in the log domain, it normalizes each individual observer to the average of the group. So it's kind of pushing the range that they are using towards a kind of a common range. Okay, does that make sense? So you can see here that this has worked quite nicely, that the six comparisons are really very similar now after the normalization between the online and the lab-based. The only difference there we can see on the A to C comparison is also the largest difference here on the raw data. So I'm not overly concerned that we've got this little bump, because observer data is noisy. It's inherently noisy. And sometimes you just get these outliers. So another way we can compare these two groups is by looking at the observer variability. So on the left-hand side, on the green side, we've got the lab-based, and the blue on the right is for the online stats. And so what we've done is we've used a metric called stress, And it's you can think of it as a sort of somewhere between a correlation and a standard deviation. It's a measure of variability between two groups or two sets of information. And it's particularly good for working out the intra and inter observer variability for colour difference experiments. That's really what it was designed for. So if I look here at this inter observer stress, so this is the, if you like, the difference between observers, the average here of 22 and 19, both the expert and non-experts, I mean, the variability is very, very similar. But if you look at the variability of online, can you see that that stress value goes up to 30 or 29? So what that tells us is there's far greater variability in our online data than there is in our lab-based data. So the story there really is that if you have enough observers, online will, on average, give you a result that can be normalised to the lab results. But within the group, it's still noisier. Okay. We can look at that in a different way. What does observer behaviour and variability tell you about your data? And so what I've done here is on the x-axis, I've got the visual difference, the delta V, from 0 to 100. And then for each of these image and gamut comparisons, I've mapped, in this case, I've put the 95th percentile, but you could use standard deviation, it would give you the same kind of graph. So essentially, we have the lowest variability in small differences. So if an observers judge a difference to be small, they're quite certain about it. Then you've got sort of medium uncertainty for the larger differences, but then you've got far greater uncertainty in the middle of the range. Okay, so the one way that you could interpret that is to say that this additional uncertainty means the observers found the task harder. Okay? And obviously, if your uncertainty is lower, it must be an easy task, because the easier the task, the more consistent they're going to be. So, as well as...
This is for all the data, for all the images.
It is, yes. Yeah. So, as well as getting your average results from your observers, always think about quantifying either the uncertainty or what you might think of as observer noise. I think that's a very important thing to do. So we've worked out that some psychophysics can be moved online, and in our case, making a magnitude estimation of difference between simulated prints, that works both in the lab and online. And of course, we went on and did it with more gamuts and more images and more observers. So here are the conclusions. Online delivery is suitable for certain types of experiment. I'm not sure you can say every kind of experiment. But when it would appear that when you're making a comparative judgment between two images, that it works out. Inter-observer variability is far greater for the online studies, and that if you combine results across different modes of delivery, then you have to normalise it together in some way. The downside is the learning curve. If you're using something like PsychoPy, it is a big investment in time to learn it. And as with all experiments, you need to test it and you need to run a pilot of the experiment to kind of even out all these problems before you pass it on to a large number of observers. So we had a paper based on this work at CIC last year, estimating visual difference and how we moved it from the lab to online. And there's a couple of books I can recommend. If you're interested in psychophysics, the Gescheider book is a fantastic starting point because it's about the ideas and the concepts rather than getting deep into statistical analysis. And it's got lots of really good examples. And then on the right, the Engeldrum book, The Psychometric Scaling. This, I have to say, I've always found it quite a tough read. It's quite heavy on the stats, but this is kind of, you know, this is the go-to text if you want to justify what statistical methods you're using. And finally, useful websites. The one on the right, QuickEval, you saw that earlier. That's Marius Pedersen's engine for running these experiments, and I really recommend that you get involved with that. And on the left, there's a website at Oxford on an introduction to running online experiments, and they're based out of their psychology department. But they've documented a lot of the issues that we've discussed this afternoon. And that's it.
Yes.
So, any questions? Or are you... need more coffee.
So just yesterday in our talk, in your lecture, you were talking about, I mean, just you raised a problem, like when you're having online online psychophysical experiments, some of the users are actually giving unreliable data.
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Some of the observers, when the psychophysical experiment is online, some of the observers are giving unreliable data. Uh-huh.
So this is the ethical problem, right? Just because someone doesn't give you the answer that you were expecting doesn't mean it's the wrong answer. However, you have to be smart about this. There may be people who just completely misunderstood the task. There could be some people who just hit the button and it's random. Or it might be that people are internally just very inconsistent. And so it's important to identify those outliers. There is an ethical question about whether or not you should remove them from the data. So if you do that, I think you have to have a good justification for doing it. But it does happen.
I need to...
No, that's fine. That overran a
Thanks
bit.
Thanks for the presentation. Then we meet tomorrow, Friday.
Yes.
Okay.
See you 4:10. Okay. Good. Thanks.
You have been to your court.
Oh my goodness. All right. Oh, yeah.
When we know that the stress value in online is very high,